Chapter 38. Harmed by awakening feelings they were trying to subdue. Of all this, Claire was unconscious. Passing on to the wicket gate, he shook hands with the dairyman and his wife, and expressed his last thanks to them for their attentions, after which there was a moment of silence, before they had moved off. It was interrupted by the crowing of a cock. The white one with the rose comb had come, and settled on the palings in front of the house, within a few yards of them, and his notes thrilled their ears through, dwindling away like echoes down a valley of rocks. "Oh?" said Mrs. Crick. "An afternoon crow." Two men were standing by the yard gate, holding it open. "That's bad," one murmured to the other, not thinking that the words could be heard by the group at the door wicket. The cock crew again straight towards Claire. "Well," said the dairyman. "I don't like to hear him," said Tess to her husband. "Tell the man to drive on. Goodbye, goodbye." The cock crew again. "Hoosh. Just you be off, sir, or I'll twist your neck," said the dairyman with some irritation, turning to the bird and driving him away. And to his wife as they went indoors, colon now. "To think, oh, that just today, I've not heard his crow of an afternoon all the year afore. It only means a change in the weather," said she, "not what you think. 'Tis impossible." XXXIV, they drove by the level road along the valley to a distance of a few miles, and, reaching Wellbridge, turned away from the village to the left, and over the Great Elizabethan Bridge which gives the place half its name. Immediately behind it stood the house wherein they had engaged lodgings, whose exterior features are so well known to all travelers through the Froom Valley, once portion of a fine manorial residence, and the property and seat of a d'Urberville, but since its partial demolition a farmhouse. "Welcome to one of your ancestral mansions," said Claire as he handed her down. But he regretted the pleasantry, it was too near a satire. On entering they found that, though they had only engaged a couple of rooms, the farmer had taken advantage of their proposed presence during the coming days, to pay a New Year's visit to some friends, leaving a woman from a neighboring cottage to minister to their few wants. The absoluteness of possession pleased them, and they realized it as the first moment of their experience under their own exclusive roof tree. But he found that the moldy old habitation somewhat depressed his pride. When the carriage was gone, they ascended the stairs to wash their hands, the charwoman showing the way. On the landing, Tess stopped and started. "What's the matter?" said he. "Those horrid women," she answered with a smile. "How they frightened me." He looked up, and perceived two life-size portraits on panels built into the masonry. As all visitors to the mansion are aware, these paintings represent women of middle age, of a date some 200 years ago, whose lineaments once seen can never be forgotten. The long pointed features, narrow eye, and smirk of the one, so suggestive of merciless treachery, the billhook nose, large teeth, and bold eye of the other suggesting arrogance to the point of ferocity, haunt the beholder afterwards in his dreams. "Whose portraits are those?" asked Claire of the charwoman. "I have been told by old folk that they were ladies of the d'Urberville family, the ancient lords of this manor," she said, "when to their being builded into the wall they can't be moved away." The unpleasantness of the matter was that, in addition to their effect upon Tess, her fine features were unquestionably traceable in these exaggerated forms. He said nothing of this, however, and, regretting that he had gone out of his way to choose the house for their bridal time, went on into the adjoining room. The place having been rather hastily prepared for them, they washed their hands in one basin. Claire touched hers under the water. "Which are my fingers, and which are yours?" he said, looking up. "They are very much mixed." "They are all yours," said she, very prettily, and endeavored to be gayer than she was. He had not been displeased with her thoughtfulness on such an occasion. It was what every sensible woman would show. But Tess knew that as he had been thoughtful to excess, and struggled against it. The sun was so low on that short last afternoon of the year that it shone in through a small opening and formed a golden staff which stretched across to her skirt, where it made a spot like a paint mark set upon her. They went into the ancient parlor to tea, and here they shared their first common meal alone. Such was their childishness, or rather his, that he found it interesting to use the same bread and butter plate as herself, and to brush crumbs from her lips with his own. He wondered a little that she did not enter into these frivolities with his own zest. Looking at her silently for a long time, "She is a dear, dear Tess," he thought to himself, as one deciding on the true construction of a difficult passage. "Oh, I realize solemnly enough how utterly and irretrievably this little womanly thing is the creature of my good or bad faith and fortune. I think not. I think I could not, unless I were a woman myself. What I am in worldly estate, she is. What I become, she must become. What I cannot be, she cannot be. And shall I ever neglect her, or hurt her, or even forget to consider her? God forbid such a crime." They sat on over the tea table waiting for their luggage, which the dairyman had promised to send before it grew dark. But evening began to close in, and the luggage did not arrive, and they had brought nothing more than they stood in. With the departure of the sun, the calm mood of the winter day changed. Out of doors there began noises, as of silk smartly rubbed. The restful dead leaves of the preceding autumn were stirred to irritated resurrection, and whirled about unwillingly, and tapped against the shutters. It soon began to rain. "That cock knew the weather was going to change," said Claire. The woman who had attended upon them had gone home for the night, but as he had placed candles upon the table, and now they lit them. Each candle flame drew towards the fireplace. "These old houses are so draughty," continued Angel, looking at the flames, and at the grease guttering down the sides. "Wonder where that luggage is. We haven't even a brush and comb." "I don't know," she answered, absent-minded. "Tess, you are not a bit cheerful this evening, not at all as you used to be. Those harridans on the panels upstairs have unsettled you. I am sorry I brought you here. I wonder if you really love me, after all?" He knew that she did, and the words had no serious intent. But she was surcharged with emotion, and winced like a wounded animal. Though she tried not to shed tears, she could not help showing one or two. "I did not mean it," said he, "sorry. You are worried at not having your things, I know. I cannot think why old Jonathan has not come with them. Why, it is 7 o'clock. Ah, there he is." A knock had come to the door, and, there being nobody else to answer it, Claire went out. He returned to the room with a small package in his hand. "It is not Jonathan, after all," he said. "How vexing," said Tess. The packet had been brought by a special messenger, who had arrived at Talbothays from Emminster Vicarage immediately after the departure of the married couple, and had followed them hither, being under injunction to deliver it into nobody's hands but theirs. Claire brought it to the light. It was less than a foot long, sewed up in canvas, sealed in red wax with his father's seal, and directed in his father's hand to R.S. Angel Claire. "It is a little wedding present for you, Tess," said he, handing it to her. "How thoughtful they are." Tess looked a little flustered as she took it. "I think I would rather have you open it, dearest," said she, turning over the parcel. "Don't like to break those great seals. They look so serious. Please open it for me." He undid the parcel. Inside was a case of Morocco leather, on the top of which lay a note and a key. The note was for Claire, in the following words. "My dear son, possibly you have forgotten that on the death of your godmother, Mrs. Pitney, when you were a lad, she vain kind woman, that she was left to me a portion of the contents of her jewel case in trust for your wife, if you should ever have one, as a mark of her affection for you, and whomsoever you should choose. This trust I have fulfilled, and the diamonds have been locked up at my banker's ever since. Though I feel it to be a somewhat incongruous act in the circumstances, I am, as you will see, bound to hand over the articles to the woman to whom the use of them for her lifetime will now rightly belong, and they are therefore promptly sent. They become, I believe, heirlooms, strictly speaking, according to the terms of your godmother's will. The precise words of the clause that refers to this matter are enclosed. I do remember, said Claire, but I had quite forgotten. Unlocking the case, they found it to contain a necklace, with pendant, bracelets, and earrings, and also some other small ornaments. Tess seemed afraid to touch them at first, but her eyes sparkled for a moment as much as the stones when Claire spread out the set. Are they mine? She asked incredulously. They are, certainly, said he. He looked into the fire. He remembered how, when he was a lad of 15, his godmother, the squire's wife, the only rich person with whom he had ever come in contact, had pinned her faith to his success, had prophesied a wondrous career for him. There had seemed nothing at all out of keeping with such a conjectured career in the storing up of these showy ornaments for his wife, and the wives of her descendants. They gleamed somewhat ironically now. And why? He asked himself. It was but a question of vanity throughout, and if that were admitted into one side of the equation, it should be admitted into the other. His wife was a d'Urberville. Whom could they become better than her? Suddenly he said with enthusiasm, Tess, put them on, and he turned from the fire to help her. But as if by magic, as he had already donned them, necklace, earrings, bracelets, and all. But the gown isn't right, Tess, said Claire. T ought to be a low one for a set of brilliants like that. Ought it? Said Tess. Yes, said he. He suggested to her how to tuck in the upper edge of her bodice, so as to make it roughly approximate to the cut for evening wear, and when as he had done this, and the pendant to the necklace hung isolated amid the whiteness of her throat, as it was designed to do, he stepped back to survey her. My heavens, said Claire, how beautiful you are. As everybody knows, fine feathers make fine birds. A peasant girl, but very moderately prepossessing to the casual observer in her simple condition and attire, will bloom as an amazing beauty, if clothed as a woman of fashion with the aids that art can render, while the beauty of the midnight crush would often cut but a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.